Welcome to the Futile Podcast. Tonight it's Ian.
Pinkman.
Pinkman, that's your name today because you're wearing a pink sweatsuit.
Very comfortable.
Comfortable.
Ready to talk. Right. Comfortable movies.
Comfortable movies, like Killers of the Flower Moon,
directed
by Martin Scorsese.
Big directors.
Their two biggest movies, both on the Apple streamer, both long.
I mean, is Napoleon really that long?
246 is still long.
I think it's medium now.
As a quote unquote epic period movie,
okay.
It's not as long as like something like Lawrence of Arabia or quite a few other ones. So it's kind of comparable, which I think might lead to some of my criticisms of it later. And Killers of the Flower Moon
was long
and felt maybe more like it was better suited as like a mini series kind of thing.
3:26.
3 hours and 26 minutes for Flower Moon and yeah. 2 hours and 46 minutes for
38
is what it, Napoleon is? Two, mm-hmm. Only 2:38?
Mm-hmm.
Why did I get 46? Oh, I'm thinking of Dune Part 2 maybe.
Because I was definitely expecting Napoleon to be a long period piece.
Right.
And it's only 2:38 and you're like, oh. Especially with all the credits.
Right, yeah, all the visual effects and
little
stuff.
Little 2:30 movie, yeah.
I know.
Which is nice.
Both are historical stories.
Historical
so that's their
dramas.
Historical dramas that are based on true things. That are, at least from my perspective, two things that I know very little about. I don't know a lot about world history.
Yes.
So I knew a bit about the person of Napoleon. And my impression has always been, probably going back to something like Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure and other things, is that he's short and he's goofy. He's like the goofy dictator of this weird period in history, and he's French, so they make fun of him for that and everything else. But he's not French. So I was after watching this movie and even kind of before, I was kind of interested in that historical period and kind of what was going on with that person. And, you know, like he gets crowned emperor and his rise to power after the context of the French Revolution, where they get rid of the monarchy and everything, like for them to then get rid of the monarchy and then turn around like less than 10 years later and crown some guy emperor.
Hell yeah.
Is pretty interesting. So yeah. So I watched this four-part documentary on YouTube from like, it was made like probably like in the early 2000s or something from like the CBC or something.
About
Napoleon, because I wanted
before watching it.
No, after watching it, because I was kind of curious what was missing, and you know, if there was anything else there to kind of compare it to. And there was a few things. I don't know about necessarily things. There were things that were missing. I don't know that they necessarily got anything really wrong in the movie, but maybe certain impressions.
I wouldn't know.
Maybe right, exactly. I was kind of thinking, well, I'll be.
I was just, for both the movies. I was definitely just in it to. For the historical drama part of it, I guess.
Right. Yeah, I didn't know anything about the story of
which
the.
I think is a big part of historical dramas is knowing the background information.
You think that's a big part of appreciating them?
Yes.
Is actually having the real history.
At
think
least
you appreciate
the
it more?
Part that the movie wants you to know.
Well,
because
okay.
With. Because I recently read Edward II by Marlowe for my Shakespeare class. And I can imagine reading it without the historical context we got in the class beforehand and after. And it was, I can tell the experience was something different because I got the historical context. And I know we're not specifically talking Oppenheimer today, but looking back at Oppenheimer, the most memorable parts for me were the parts where I knew something about the characters beforehand. And that was the parts with Truman
mm-hmm.
and Einstein. Those were the parts that I connected with the most because I think I knew something, if anything, about them compared to the rest of the characters in the movie that I knew nothing about. So, like with Truman calling him a crybaby. I think it's funny that he called him a crybaby in the first place. But I knew that Truman, that was a name that existed in the first place. And it was cool to see dialogue, even though apparently Crybaby is a real thing Truman said, given to a character like Truman that I don't know much about besides the name.
Right.
And then him saying that dialogue out loud, and a character and an actor playing that character out. And so that's what I think gives the historical drama something to that's what gives it the entertaining value. Maybe not entertaining is the wrong word, but that's what you enjoy when watching historical drama, is the characters that you know from history being played out in this theatrical way, given life in this way.
Right. So that's, you're getting at an interesting idea, which is sort of the confluence of reality and fiction. When you do a story that's based on or inspired by true events, it can be almost the most kind of problematic kind of fiction. Because, Oliver Stone has gotten in trouble with this a few times. You know, Oliver Stone's made movies about the JFK assassination and Richard Nixon and a lot of kind of very, like, kind of quote-unquote controversial subjects and ideas. And, you know, there's people that are just like, well, wait a minute, you know, you took some artistic liberties here. You know, that guy didn't meet this guy in that way. So that's the kind of, when I said problematic aspect of these movies, is do people watch these things with a little bit of historical knowledge? Like, oh, I know who Truman was a president, and I know Einstein was a physicist.
He was a smart guy.
They know just enough to kind of think that the story, like, it kind of grounds them in the, oh, like, hey, I know that character, or I know this person, you know? And then they walk away from the movie kind of feeling like, oh, I know what really happened back then. And it's like, no, you don't. Because one, you weren't alive. So, and two, you don't really know the history, which would require not reading one person's book about it, but multiple, you know.
I think that's why they use the word stories, entertain here.
Exactly.
Because that's what documentaries are for. Documentaries are for figuring out exactly what Einstein said or did at a certain date. While the historical drama is playing on what maybe a documentary would tell you and giving you the entertainment from using these historical characters.
Well, and then I'll add another wrinkle to the idea, which is an interesting debate I'd like to have at some point with somebody, is on what level is a documentary all that objective? Most documentaries are not. They take a side, they present that side. There's a lot of advocacy in a lot of documentaries. There's a lot of reenactments that happen in many documentaries where they hire actors to basically play a scene. You essentially are starting to muddy the waters between quote unquote objective journalism in the form of a documentary and fiction. There's, you know, like if a director tells somebody to, like, look up somewhere, you know, to, like, or restages, you know, like, the background in an interview to make it look like somebody's got, like, say somebody has, like, an Oscar that they won for a movie, and they have it up in their basement because they don't really give a shit about it, and then they come to interview this person for a movie about movies or documentary about movies, and then they're like, hey, let's take that Oscar and let's stage it behind them, and it makes it look like they have it on their mantle all the time. No, they don't. That was staged. That's now creating a different framework. Once again, we're getting at kind of like this skepticism of the media, to go back to the satire movies and the dystopia movies.
I don't know if that's related.
Well, no, but you do, because there has to be this kind of healthy, you know, take it with a grain of salt. Like, okay, this is entertaining, this is interesting. And so what it really comes down to is character study pieces, I think, in a lot of these historical things.
That's what movies are.
Right? Yeah, well, not always. Sometimes they're about just a plot, just a heist plot. Just watch these characters you don't know. But it's
about the characters.
Well, like a good movie does a good plot with interesting character development too. But something like Napoleon has, like, things that happened historically, like bullet points that maybe they decide to hit. But it's about him, yeah.
Somewhat. Maybe that's a different thing for Killers, is it's actually about the event and not the characters. Or less, more of the event.
Yeah, I think that's where, I mean, so we should probably try to get into one of these movies. Which one do you want to dive into first, Killers or Napoleon? We decided Killers, because it's been longer since we've seen it. we'll have to rack our memories a bit. So it's based on a, inspired by a true story of, I remember, I forget the tribe's name now, but a bunch of Native Americans, which, you know, I don't know, I'm not going to worry about the politically correct thing, if that's not politically correct anymore to say that.
I think you're
yeah.
all right.
With yeah. Native American. Was it Oklahoma? Or somewhere. Basically, the upshot of the deal is it's about oil.
Osage.
Yeah, Osage. The Osage. Osage.
Oklahoma.
In Oklahoma. And they end up, they have some land.
In the 1920s.
And their land is rich with oil. So bingo, bango, we don't waste a lot of time conveying this idea that these people are now wealthy because they have oil. Mm-hmm. In the 20s, when it was the big thing to have. And then it just kind of comes down to the sort of the non-natives, non-part of the people that aren't part of the tribe, kind of coming in and trying to kind of weasel their way in to get this oil.
Yeah.
And, you know, a superficial reading of it would be like, okay, these guys are just all weaseling in on this. They don't really care about these people. And at the beginning, you're presented with maybe a bit more nuance than that. You get a sense like, okay, Robert De Niro plays this guy who's kind of lived within...
He knows, you know, the language.
He knows the language. He's read some books. He seems like he kind of cares.
And he cares enough to know.
And it's his community, yeah. too, right? You know? And so DiCaprio comes in as like his nephew, fresh out of World War One or whatever, with, you know, he was like a cook or something. It doesn't sound like he did much in World War One. And kind of playing is, it's DiCaprio doing one of his three things, you know? He's either sort of cool, like in Inception or The Aviator or something, or he's kind of a dumb shit. He's kind of the new De Niro in that sense. De Niro either plays dumb shits or kind of badasses, sort of. I mean, I don't know. Maybe DiCaprio doesn't really play badasses, but... So he's playing a dumb shit in this one for sure. Just kind of putting on his accent. And De Niro's kind of trying to teach him to go, you know, respect these people maybe or something. And, you know, the idea is that these guys are trying to marry into the tribe, but finding these women that are, for whatever reasons, like, I feel like it doesn't explain enough about, like, the circumstances of the situation, because you get this sense that, like, some of the people in the tribe have, like, more of a say in what they can do with their money, and some don't, and it's certainly if they're women, and so you kind of just assume, okay, well, it's because it's the 20s, like, women don't even have the right to vote yet, necessarily. I forget exactly when that amendment was passed, but... So, okay, you can understand that, and it's, you know, still the government kind of controlling this all, too. And so it's just a scheme. It's really just a crime movie scheme thing. But for the runtime and for the kind of way it's trying to sort of subtly get at things, at least seemingly at the beginning, my biggest problem with it was just that it felt like just at the snap of a finger, the drop of a hat, all of a sudden... The De Niro character is kind of showing his true colors, that he's kind of a scumbag, that he's definitely sort of like you're like, oh, okay, that's actually what's going on. As opposed to, maybe that's what's going on. Is there going to be some nuance here? Is there going to be like a subtle shift into these guys becoming more greedy and more kind of evil? Or is it just going to be like, oh no, they just always have been that way. We're hiding it, and now they're not hiding it
as much. It's been a while, but I do think I do remember, like, just being confused a lot with the De Niro character, because you look at his face, and even in the beginning when you don't know, it's like he always has that smile that you're like, that's an evil smile, right? Like, you are definitely, you're like, you're putting on that evil smile because you want us to know that you're not exactly, even though you know the language, you're not exactly all
great
pro
yeah
Asagi here. But yeah, I'm not.
Yeah, that was my biggest problem, is it was just, there was something about it was too abrupt. Like, all of a sudden, it's just like the curtain drops, and it's just like, oh, okay. And then at that point, I was like, the only bias I had coming into the movie was this sense that a lot of people were really kind of virtue signaling out there that the main female performance was really good. And I think it was a good performance, but it wasn't really her movie as much as I wanted it to be and thought would have made it a better movie. Like it kind of leans into, like, Scorsese kind of indulges in his idiot crime thing a bit. And you're kind of almost just, I think I chuckled, or maybe I straight up laughed, at a couple of sequences towards the middle to the end when just the dumb shits are just being, like, such dumb shits. You know, it's kind of like in Wolf of Wall Street or something where you're just like, okay. And I was like, I just don't think this fit in this context for this kind of movie. Like, it seemed like a more grounded, sort of serious, kind of, for lack of a better term, kind of dramatic thing, and about, like, this character and her struggle to try to get some sort of justice for herself. And she's literally being poisoned. She's
bedridden for, like, two-thirds of the movie, I feel like.
And so that was disappointing to me. I think it's always tough. That's why I try to avoid as many biases going into a movie as I can. Both other people's opinions, seeing trailers, whatever. Because I don't want to start getting an idea of what kind of movie I'm going to watch. And then when it's not that, I'm criticizing it for not being that, which is kind of not fair. So Scorsese made kind of a Goodfellas movie in the second half of this. But it's like period piece Goodfellas with oil and Indians. And it's like, okay.
That's what I think.
And then in the third act, the final bit, Jesse Plemons' character comes in as like, and it's kind of like the U.S. Marshals are here to save the day. And I don't know if it's some kind of pro-government thing, kind of. It still has that savior thing going, which is a bit unsavory. Like, it would have just...
Yeah.
And maybe he was... I mean, hey, it's based on a real story, and maybe the real story worked out that way. You can't have the main character who's bedridden all of a sudden wake up and be like, wait a minute, they're poisoning me, and be actualized and strong and powerful. If that's not what happened, that would feel really pandery, probably. So...
No, I think... Yeah, I guess... That raises the question of what should you do plot-wise with the historical drama. And that's why I think the part of the character comes in, where, like, no matter what, you're going to have your plot where maybe the bad guys win in the end in this particular story. But that's not why you're making the movie. You're making the movie because this character is interesting. That's why you're capitalizing on the drama here of the character. And so that's why I'm thinking Killers of the Flower Moon doesn't quite... work, is because you have your big Leo face here as your main guy, and I don't see him, like, as dramatic, I guess, as I think I was hoping. Maybe I shouldn't have been hoping for it, but it seemed like he was in the beginning, like, just kind of, like, clueless, didn't know what he wanted exactly, and then he gets this chick that we are not sure if he likes, because he's, like, kind of coaxed into liking her and marrying her because we know that they just want the oil, but maybe he actually does really like her, but he's also going through with poisoning her to kill her, and he knows it. But then he, like, also has this moment where he doesn't want to, like, fully kill her, I think. And so it's just a very big confusing part from Leo where I, like...
Right.
Not sure what you're pulling off with your acting right here. And so I'm, like, not getting that dramatic part of a historical drama. I mean, I'm getting more of the documentary, which is of what I really was feeling from a few of the scenes, like the really long scene with the tribe in the tent talking about how the whole thing was really bad for them and how their people are slowly dying from... all this whole situation. When I was watching the theater, I was like, is this really part of this Scorsese cinematic movie here, where it's just this one guy talking for like 5 straight minutes? That's what, at least what it felt like. I was like, this is a documentary here, is it not?
Yeah, that guy's performance felt a little wooden or something too. Like, that, I wouldn't say documentary because it's still shot and looks like a movie and stuff. Which, I mean, documentaries can look good, but it did. Yeah, that part stood out. And yeah, the thing about Leo, you're getting to another one of my kind of... So for the length of the movie, things that to me should feel like, if you're trying to hit those character moments, are kind of washed over. I was confused for most of the movie as to whether or not, okay, they skipped ahead a bunch and now he's married and they have a couple of kids, or if they had adopted kids from one of her sisters that was killed, or what was going on. But it's like all of a sudden, if they have children, they've built a family, like you can only kind of fake that so much. That would add that kind of ambiguity as to whether or not he cares about his family, he loves her or not, which would make it work better later on. And so that didn't quite work. That didn't land as well. I don't know that there's any more evidence there to get from that. I'm pretty good at picking that stuff
up. I feel
like
I was very confused when watching it. And I feel like that's even with Oppenheimer. I'm like, well, maybe if I rewatched it and I knew all the characters and what they were doing, I'm sure there's a lot of examples of movies where if you rewatch it and you now know what things are happening, you get more out of it.
That's always it's two things, right? The movie has to be compelling enough for you to want to rewatch it, first of all. Yeah. And it has to be something where that feels feasible. At 3 hours and 24 26. Minutes or whatever, you have to be like, okay, did you enjoy that enough that you want to rewatch that? Well, maybe
it's an intermission type movie where you actually do take a break halfway in between.
Well, even so, that's still a lot of time. I don't know that I think I got it enough that I don't think there's going to all of a sudden be some scene where everything locks in for me.
It's the whole movie. It won't be a single scene.
Right. Well, but usually there's those moments in movies that kind of do connect certain things. And I mean, it's still just glossed over it. You know, they're married. I get that. And then, now he speaks the language somewhat fluently, when the sister, the drunk sister shows up and he kind of is speaking to her in the language, and you get a sense that he's maybe kind of like the patriarch of their little group kind of now, and everyone's kind of in their house, but then their kids running around, but you don't really know, is it just their kids? And now all of a sudden that's how you know that it's 5 years later or something. Like, it doesn't have a title card or anything, I don't think. So that... I think we agree that it's just like you said, you didn't get enough kind of compelling character drama for Leo's character to get a sense of that conflict within him about the family and the marriage and this woman versus just the wealth and the oil to be rich, I guess, and to not have to work hard for a living or something. And okay, fine. That's the main thing.
Yeah, because also this isn't just about Leo. We have a whole bunch of characters, and that's what makes this 3D26. And so that's why I think I'm calling this more of a movie where less like Napoleon. It's more like The Event, where that's even the title is The Killers of the Flower Moon, where it's about the
ensemble cast
event of the killing of this tribe for it. And so when it's more about the event, you get less of the characters, where even though Leo is the main character, especially since he's a little bit confusing, but even more so when you have the other characters that are kind of one dimensional, it's I forget the actress's name, but she's probably the most
compelling. The wife?
Yeah, the wife.
I think her name is Lily Gladstone.
She's probably the most compelling she's, I guess, the, I don't know.
The character I thought was going to be the main character, kind of. And that we would kind of follow as our kind of sort of moral compass through the story or something. And it kind of is. She kind of is. But at the same time, she really kind of isn't. And then historically, I guess that's just the way it goes.
We get a bunch of other characters that... I don't feel the drama with, I guess.
Right. There's a bit... And like I said, it does kind of opt for humor towards that last part, when you're just dealing with these, like I said, FBI. For lack of a better term, the dipshits and then the marshals going after them. I think it's marshals. I don't think they're FBI. They might have been pre...
Isn't it about the creation of...
Well, it's not about the creation, but you're right. I think you're right. I think it was FBI. Agency? I think they were, kind of early... Mr. Hoover said you brought us out here or something. So I think they might have been. Because marshals don't really deal with that, I don't think. Who knows? It's all a soup.
I did like the little asides to the two faceless guys, like, or maybe it was more than two, but like when they would randomly, not randomly, but like show the guys in like the middle of the night or whatever doing the murders against the Osage.
Oh, like, right. Or the one in the broad daylight where it was pretty blatant, where the guy just shoots the lady with the baby in the carriage and everything.
Oh, yeah.
That was pretty brutal. That was pretty blunt. That was pretty like, okay, we get it. Yeah, these guys are just
cold-blooded. I felt like the plot was advancing at least compared to just talking
about sure.
and slowly
yeah.
insert
that was
drawing
pretty,
poison. And...
That was pretty early on, that first one.
Aren't they sprinkled, the killings?
There's a few, yeah, they are. But that one with the baby is pretty early in the movie okay. to kind of just convey like, okay, yeah, this is what's happening. Like, we could have figured that out. I guess I feel like it's just kind of... It's not as... For the runtime and for the kind of expectation with the kind of writing and directing that we're bringing to this, it's not as not as elegant or nuanced.
You didn't like the parts when they...
As I...
Skipped to the...
No, I mean, whatever. That was fine. But there was also weird choices in the editing where it's like, okay, you'll see... Somebody at one point there's a courtroom drama element to it towards the end.
That's the end.
And
yeah.
somebody gives like testimony of what happens.
And that's when Brendan Fraser comes in.
Yeah, right.
And I'm like, I'm just laughing, like, oh, it's fat Brendan Fraser. Sure, I'm not thinking about the movie anymore.
Yeah, okay, that's too bad. He was kind of a big character in that movie though. But you get a guy testifying to what actions he took and then cut to them showing like a flashback to that action, those actions being taken. And it's just like, is this, once again, you're playing the runtime game and you're like, so was it worth seeing it? Or should we have seen that sooner and then heard about it being told later? Like,
oh, the guy's testifying.
The editing there was weird. There was a couple other spots where it was just like, okay, clearly it was a choice. I just don't know if it worked for me. Either to have it or to have it as like a flashback the way that they did it.
Yeah, it was like flashback. Back or
yeah, it flash. Was, but it was like right after the testimony, so it's kind of like, okay, you're just showing us what the guy just told us, and maybe you should have shown us that when it happened, and then we would be kind of ahead of, the audience would be ahead in some way, but yeah. we already know these people are murdering people, and so if you're trying to, sometimes if you want to pull drama and emotion from an audience, the audience kind of has to be ahead of some of the characters. That's how you get yeah. tension in drama too. It's like it's the Hitchcock thing.
Is he going to say the fact that they killed him in cold blood?
Right, exactly. We know this whole time, but you know it's you know. So, I mean, yeah, I think I don't remember what I gave it as a star rating, but I think it just didn't. It disappointed me a little bit. I don't think I'm going to rewatch
so long.
It. It was so long, yeah, and it was.
It didn't
for the runtime, it still had weird moments. It felt muddled and rushed in places. Like it wasn't well put together or well, terribly well structured. Cause I'm still like, okay, so why skip over the stuff where he, you know, let's see them have a newborn baby at least. And that a 2 second scene would then convey that they do have children together now. Like, that's a big part of building a family of anything else. There's none of that in this 2 hour and 46 minute movie, or 2 hour and 3 hour and... I keep going, it's 2:46. This 3:26.
Yeah.
And I'm done. I'm going to shut up about fucking runtime on this. yeah, just why didn't it work? Usually, you're left being like, that was too short and they must have cut something out that would have made this work more for me. But in this case, like, it was too long and they still didn't, they chose to keep other things. And I don't know what I would have cut necessarily. Once again, it just, the content was entertaining. I don't know about entertaining because it's kind of a sad story and everything, but it was engaging enough that I watched the whole movie fully engaged. I wasn't checking my phone or anything, but it just, I guess it. I felt like I just binged through a mini series or something, you know, like a four episode
maybe it would have been better split up.
Or you know, it would have been better with a little more content, split up, yeah. you know, into like five episodes or something.
You gave it
That, but then it's content, and these guys don't want to do that. I don't think Scorsese wants to be a guy whose last next movie is a TV show. He doesn't want to feel that way. Yeah. David Lynch, when he came back to do the new Twin Peaks, which is 18 episodes, like hours each, as like apparently said that like this is a feature film, this is a movie, and it's like fuck off, dude. You made an 18 episode TV show, and you don't want to get the TV stink on it or the content stink on it. You want to still pretend you make movies, but hey, it's a new world. It's weird. We're either doing TikTok videos that are 2 minutes long, or we're doing overlong content, you know, that is a movie, yeah, quote unquote, or whatever.
I'll still like think of Bebop as the director. I don't know his name actually.
Shinichiro Watanabe.
I'll think of him as one of the greatest directors ever because he made Bebop, not because it was a TV show or it was a movie, but because it's Bebop.
Well, you can think that way, sure. I mean, and so like the more movies you see and the more things you see, where you see that like a Tarantino, he's lifting a lot of good stuff. But yeah, I mean, I would agree that I think one of the things that makes that anime so good is the attention to detail and the fact that it is directed. Choices of blocking, yeah, and camera angles and things where it's definitely in the upper echelon of anime. I think something like Ava has some of that, yeah, but not a lot of other anime I can think of where like I can think, okay, visually they're doing things that are interesting with like framing of action, yeah, sequences or how they're telling the story, you know, where characters are moving and stuff. And not every second of Bebop is like that. I mean, it's still a TV show. It has a TV budget in some places. You know, there'll be one character who stands still and blinks for 2 seconds, and that's the only movement in the whole shot for a second. But it's high end. I'm not going to knock it. But yeah, I mean, that's a different way of thinking, though.
I think Scorsese is just like, oh, I can't do a TV show ever.
No, he directed and produced Boardwalk Empire, the TV show. He got like production credit and directed like the pilot, which a lot of big directors will come in. They'll direct like a pilot of a bigger TV show, and then get producer credit probably just because they directed the first episode, or maybe they were involved in some story stuff. So he's not above being associated with certain projects, I don't think. I think it's just a different mindset that as like we talked about off pod, don't ever say pod, about Hateful Eight and Tarantino taking it to Netflix and then adding more content to turn it into a TV show. That is literally like what all these long movies are feeling like now. And Tarantino is opening himself up to this idea of not necessarily, like I think he has a fidelity to the idea of what a movie is. And so when he says he's going to only direct one more movie, I think there'll be a lot of loopholes in that. And I'm sure that if he lives quite a bit longer, he'll probably direct a couple more movies, but he may write books. He may just mean he doesn't care about the strict definition of what kind of content he produces.
He'll write one or two scripts or drafts for books and be like, oh, I need to make this into a movie.
Or make it into a TV show. Yeah. Or make it into who knows what.
No, but I think the thing with, I feel like we were talking one time about how we didn't like the name TV show for things like The Hateful Eight on Netflix, where it's not like, it's just a big feature divided up.
Well, it's what they used to make, and the term wouldn't say it fell out of favor, it just kind of disappeared as a kind of content. For a while, like the big networks like NBC, CBS, ABC, you know, back in the day, those were the channels that you could get on like over the air. You know, you didn't have to have cable. They had budgets to do things like TV movies, you know, so they would make a movie that was made for TV. Part of that is sometimes what they would do is they would also take like a big book and they would adapt it into what would be called like a TV miniseries. Things like, and they were big events. Some of them were like two nights. So two movie nights. So you'd have like a Sunday night and then a Monday night. In a weird way, that's how they would do it. for a lot of them. So it'd be like, okay, it's a 2 hour TV block. That's about an hour and a half ish, hour 45 of time without the ads. And then the next day, so you're talking about a 3 hour movie right there, but that's a mini series. And some were more than just two episodes. I don't know how long Roots was. Roots was a big one. There was one called Shogun. And then there was one called Rich Man, Poor Man. This is what I think as the golden age of modern TV is kind of fading and losing favor a bit, because there's been kind of an oversaturation of it. And there's been a lot of shows that came out that were good, but then even despite their shorter episode quantity per season, they still went on too long as a show. And people are starting to sort of see the money. People are getting smart about, you know what, this thing hits and it's popular, it's huge, everybody talks about it for the first season or two maybe, but by the time the story's wrapping up in the third or fourth, people are still there and they might like be a big event to watch the final episode, but it's losing its luster, it's losing its grip. So the way to really do a lot of these things is to go back to the shorter, not just a shorter season, but the shorter storytelling, more like a novel. Something like True Detective. I don't know if you've seen that, but the first True Detective season is 8 episodes and then it's done. It's an extended mini series. And that there's kind of a perfect sweet spot there. Just like with anime, with good anime, like Cowboy Bebop, it's a fixed number of episodes and then it's done. Yeah. And so you can literally tell someone, oh, True Detective. And they're like, what's a TV show? Like we were trying earlier, Ryan and I were talking to you about Battlestar, and that's still in that older, that's in that golden age of television era where you had shorter number of episodes per season. So you had better production value and like more bang for the buck per scene. A better show, better written show, usually, because they didn't just have to fill a bunch of content. But it's still 4, 5, 6 seasons, still 70 episodes when you sit down and think about it, right?
Yeah.
And so the idea of getting at, like I said, the miniseries is just the sweet spot. I think that's where I'm landing at stuff. You know, that's why I got into a lot of anime for a while, because I liked it. It was the genre stuff of science fiction and fantasy stuff that could be done because it's drawn, it could be affordable. Now you're at the point where with live action, quote unquote live action, it's still visual effects, it's still animation. You could do a big science fiction, you could take a science fiction book series and do it more faithfully as a mini series, as opposed to doing a movie that's like, well, they had to cut this, and this out of this awesome science fiction series.
Depends on what you want.
Because, yeah, exactly. It depends on what you're trying to do, but
Scorsese wants that beautiful historical epic.
He wants that historical epic movie, and okay. Like I said, it didn't work for me as that.
Yeah.
And in that sense, I'm like, maybe it would have worked better with more content and done as a miniseries. The historical epic, a lot of those miniseries were historical epics like that. That is the kind of, that pseudo-melodrama historical epic stuff really is the meat and potatoes of an old-school miniseries.
He needed people to not have main movies where they showed people getting murdered, and that way this could be a new thing where he's showing people getting murdered.
Okay,
people
right.
Saying, "I'll give a damn."
Right.
You gave it 3 stars, saying there will be casinos, hotels, resorts, Ozempic.
Yeah, Ozempic is the weight loss, the diabetic drug that now people are using to lose weight.
Huh. Okay.
That's a double joke, because I guess Paul Thomas Anderson is I don't know if he's credited or uncredited with some of the writing on the screenplay for it. Paul Thomas Anderson did There Will Be Blood, which is also about oil, and set kind of a little bit before this movie.
I gave it 3 stars and wrote too long.
Yeah. We both have our own approach to it. So yeah, that's Killers of the Flower Moon. I think
3-star movie.
We both
agree. This is the first movie we agree on. 3 stars.
Well, yeah. Okay, we're perfectly in alignment. Yes, we were both kind of.
That's how you know.
We were both. We both agree that it's sort of disappointing in that it didn't quite land the drama for the characters, and that's usually what you what really gets you working for historical drama, because if you were, you know, just in it for the historical analysis, then you should actually look, you should research the real thing and find out about the real people.
I was
going
to ask you then, I forget, what's the definition of propaganda? Because you were going a bit about on
documentaries, one of my angles on history. A film professor I had gave a really good definition. I don't know if it was him that came up with it. Probably not. But it was kind of like this idea of like a, it's like a spectrum between the difference between art and propaganda. Is it's relative to how much the makers of the product are wanting to kind of indoctrinate or drive home a certain point, a very specific point. If no one can tell. Well, you can't really tell. Like, but if to you something is very bluntly like, oh, I get it, capitalism is bad, that's propaganda. If two people can watch something and say, capitalism is good, if they had more capitalism, these characters would have been better. And somebody else can watch it and say, no, if they had communism, then the characters would be better. Then that's art, because now there's a discussion there, seeing the nuances of what's going on in life. So art is more abstracted from like trying to make a explicit point. Now, obviously, propaganda makes use of a lot of psychological techniques and things, you know, where it's just like telling one side of a thing, or
so is your documentary multiple all things. Propaganda?
So
are all documentaries propaganda then? Because they're all one side.
They aren't all one sided, and yes, documentaries can definitely. It's definitely a fair criticism to point to certain, especially if that documentary is kind of smugly making some sort of a political statement.
Okay, if it gets into the
if it's saying to you pretty bluntly, or even not that bluntly, like, guess what? Like, you know, if we didn't have guns, we'd all be able to walk around with our doors wide open all night, you know? Okay. It's like, oh, you staged that shot to make that look that way, and you're pretending this is real. See, you can get at a greater truth about humanity in a fiction than you can in a documentary, in a kind of an ironic way. Because the documentary, a lot of times, if it's staged, it's bullshit. You're trying to tell people this is real. You're not in a movie. You know it's all staged. It's all contrived. It's all bullshit. So you take that as a given, and then you just watch the characters. You watch the performance. You get into the idea of what's going on there. So in a historical drama, you know that it's all staged. It's all bullshit. It's inspired by a true story. But you either have to leave that to the side, or in which case you really want to look at the characters and the interactions. And it's more about that. So. Yeah, like, I think it can be really dangerous and quote-unquote problematic when people allow documentary to kind of mesh with fiction. I mean, unless people are just aware, you know, like, oh, if it's just content to watch, to be entertained by, like, hey, look at they did a documentary about these goofballs that hang around and roller skate at a movie theater, and yeah, they staged that shot, or they chose that particular location this way at this time of day, and they made a sequence. Yeah. The worst of this stuff is the quote unquote reality shows, where you know it's all staged, but it's presented with it's like anything in politics or anything else. This is super cynical, but it's fucking true. It's the opposite of what it's called. A reality show is all bullshit and not at all reality.
What's the opposite?
The Inflation Reduction Act does not reduce inflation. I mean, all of these things. If they call something the Affordable Care Act, does not make health insurance more affordable. I mean, these, you know. Sorry, I'm going on a political rant here, and people can, you know, the two people that listen probably don't care.
Two is generous.
Mm. Well, maybe this will get people listening. Maybe I'll get my own show where I just rally. I'm like, and this is another thing that grinds my gears. Anyway, angry old man rant is over. But it is relevant to this topic of historical dramas, and that can lead us into Napoleon and the idea of how he's been presented in media throughout the years, and my biases about him as kind of being a short little French joke who he lost it at Waterloo. Yeah. You know,
you have I think more background with Napoleon, at least
only because I watched that series.
No. Even before that, I think you were saying like you knew he was a short, cocky guy. I think.
Yeah. That's from other media. Like that's from Bill and Ted's Awesome Adventure and stuff. Yeah.
I didn't even have any of that. All I knew was that
you had no historical context or like media context.
Yeah. All I knew, only context I had was from my 9th grade history class, where we briefly went over the French Revolution. And the fact that Napoleon was besides the general mention of how Napoleon was one of the greatest conquerors, Napoleon was one of the greatest conquerors and he failed in Russia because he tried to do it in the winter, which is never should do that.
Right.
That's a big thing you
don't get involved in a land war in Asia.
And then maybe the fact that he was short. Although I don't specifically remember that.
Yeah, and he's 5'10" or something, so not super sure. Or maybe 7. I don't remember now.
Anyways, I didn't have any. But you saw the movie earlier. How did you watch it?
The Ridley Scott film?
Yeah.
Napoleon. Okay, so Ridley Scott's done a lot of these movies. He does big historical epics. They're not always... Some are historical fiction. Some are more... You know, that's a thing. That's one of his bread and butters. And so I was like, okay, this will probably have a fairly competent sense of direction. Joaquin Phoenix is a decent actor. I didn't really know anybody else in it, and that was fine. And, I knew it had a good runtime. So in my typical fashion, I'm like, okay, I'll start watching the movie on my elliptical machine, and I'll finish it at dinner time or whatever. So I did break it into two sittings.
It came out November 22nd, so how long after did you...
I saw it when it was on Apple, so it came. I saw it a month and a half ago or something like that.
Oh,
I saw it recently. Yeah.
Okay.
I didn't see it at the theater. I saw it on streaming. But same with Flower Moon. So they're both getting the same. I didn't pay to see them at the big theater, so no, it doesn't get big theater. You did see Flower Moon.
I saw Flower Moon in the theater. Yeah. I had the nice viewing experience of the murders.
Yeah. So with Napoleon. Yeah, I was just kind of interested to see, because based on the bias I had, it's like, okay, this is going to be a story of kind of a tyrant's rise and fall. Like, that's
tyrant.
And that's the terminology. You
had the term tyrant in your head?
Well, maybe, or just, you know, someone who gains that much power through militaristic means and stuff. Yeah, and then he becomes emperor and all that. But in the context of post French Revolution, very close to that, it is a curiosity of what is going on here and how does this work? And so I watched the movie and I haven't seen anybody else's reviews, so I can't bite their rhymes on that purposefully. At least there's two people I will check out now when we're done with this. I'll check out the YouTube. A couple of YouTube people maybe, and then the Film Junk review and see what they think. Not that it will affect what I think, but I'm just to see if there's sort of a consensus about, I don't know. I think I used the word mediocre maybe in my Letterboxd review, which is maybe a bit harsh, but it didn't tell the kind of historical epic in the way I wanted to see it laid out. It kind of hit some bullet points. It hit the Egypt stuff. It hit the Russia stuff. It hit the idea of the way, you know, they're shooting cannons and look at this kind of fanciful way of warfare, right?
War stuff.
Yeah.
Strategy.
Yeah. A bit of strategy, but not that much really.
Fact that he was good at it.
But I didn't really even get that sense. And to be honest, even watching the 4-hour documentary, yeah, I only got a few things, which was just that occasionally he got, you know, he was sort of He played things in ways people had never done it before yeah. and didn't think about it. And in some cases, it's just kind of like he just threw enough people at it. And it's like, well, no, they just kept coming. And so it's like he was just willing to let enough people die. Mm, okay. It's kind of what I got from the documentary.
Yeah.
But yeah, so the stuff with Josephine, which I think is kind of a big part that is a historical thing, and the kind of his devotion to her and the whole kind of like fact that she cheats on him and stuff. You know, I guess they had to put that in the movie, but it feels like they spent more time on that than I cared to see. That was not something I was interested in necessarily. And the way that kind of made him seem as a character, he seemed very kind of goofy and comedic in those contexts always, or kind of pathetic. I don't know what the point of the value of that was. It's almost like, with Napoleon, it's like there's this sense that people have to kind of emasculate and kind of like undermine him. And I'm not quite sure why historically that's the guy that gets that. You know? Like, is it because he killed a lot of people in the context of when a lot of the wars were happening, but he also had peace and he also brought things to the French culture. In the documentary, it's like, you know, he was trying to make the cities better, and there were times of peace, but then he would be an idiot and be like, I'm going to go into Spain and try to bring them the kind of liberty that we have. He had an irony about him where it's like he wanted a sense of freedom and liberty, but he was really just leveraging that for his own power. So, okay, so he was like a politician that way. Big whoop. You know, they're all scumbag, you know, megalomaniacs. So maybe he's just the easy scapegoat for people to use. It's like, he was just a short, weird little Frenchman. Oh, he wasn't French, actually. He was Corsican. In the document, it's an island. It's an island in the Mediterranean. That's like a French colony. And in the documentary, they talk about how Corsica had rebels that were trying to, you know, kind of secede from France or get away from France. And he was sort of, his parents were kind of involved in that. And he was sort of involved in that. He really did not like the French growing up as a kid and stuff. So he has had a very interesting life in that context of like to go from being like not really, just like William, you know, Hitler wasn't German, right?
Yeah.
He's Austrian. So that's another common weird thing about some, and that the geography of that whole area is so weird and interesting in that time period, you know, where you've got these, you know, remnants of these bizarre empires and stuff.
Definitely has a, even besides it being geographically like distant, it's also a different time period, which is also a bit more mystical, which I think is a reason why I was interested to see it, because also there was like Oppenheimer came out in July, then Killers came out in May, or wait, then did May? Oh no, October. Sorry, for some reason it came out May in Cannes, then October. So July, October, and then Napoleon came out in November. So 1 month after Killers, we have another historical drama, which is already kind of. So there's a lot of historical dramas, and I.
You want me to correct you? That it's Cannes.
Can, whatever.
That's how you say it.
The
Cannes Film Festival, a big deal in France.
Okay.
Southern France. People go there so they can hang out.
I saw Joaquin Phoenix, and I was like, oh, that's a big guy from Joker. I haven't seen Joker, but I know he's a big actor. People liked him. He got the award.
Right.
Some people like Ryan don't think he should have gotten it. And I was like, I don't know much about it. It'll be 1700s war stuff. Sounds interesting. I'd like to watch it, but I never.
Late 1700s. Most of Napoleon is all early 1800s.
That time period.
Yeah, right. I know what you mean. I'm not trying to be a dick. I'm just kind of zeroing in on that.
That's fine. But I never like had a friend nearby that wanted to at the time, or also one person. A couple people in one of my classes had watched it, and I asked them what they thought of it, and they were like, kind of boring, wasn't really into it. And I was like, oh, okay. And so I never went to the theater and watched it. But all this happening. Watched it. Decided to watch it for last week. And I was... But finals was last week. And so when I finally got to watching it on Thursday night in preparation, I started it at like I think 1:30. And that was a terrible mistake because I started watching it and the guillotine happened and I was into it. And I was like, oh my God, a decapitated head. They're showing the decapitated head. I was like, this is the real deal.
You got the blood last time.
And, well, I've just never seen a decapitated head in 4K.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And then...
Sheltered life.
And then I get about... I realize later, halfway through, and I'm asleep until the credits start rolling. And then I wake back up and I'm like, oh no, I fell asleep. So we couldn't do it last week. But right after I got home, I watched the other half.
Okay.
I figured out where I left off, watched the other half, and realized I really liked it.
Interesting.
Which was weird, because I was expecting it to be bad because of the classmate that said it was boring. And I had never seen Joaquin Phoenix, so I didn't know what to expect. But I think like, kind of similar to Songbirds and Snakes, I just... let myself go with it and just was like all for the kind of act he was putting on with like the, I think the line that sums his whole act up is the, but sir, she's 15. That is but a detail, you know? and so, yeah, I liked his character. I liked how bloody and, I like the whole kind of, I don't know if romantic is the right word to describe that period, that time period in the flowery language, but I liked all that elegantness in the high class society, and
you should see Barry Lyndon, then you should watch between your idea of like the kind of dark satire where a character sort of doesn't really grow or learn anything and liking the time period, then you would, it's another long movie, but it's a Stanley Kubrick movie, Barry Lyndon. You should check
it out. Yeah, I guess I'm probably just biased towards 1800s.
Well, if you like English, what you like, you're learning these things too. You know, you have to see enough of these to be like, oh, and your tastes will change. There are things I like now that when I was in my 20s, I wasn't as into, for whatever reason, you know, just, I guess you get sick of something and then you kind of come back around to it or something. But yeah, so.
And then this is more of a, as opposed to Killers of the Flower Moon, where I think it's more about the event, we have it all about Napoleon. And yeah, it's a character story. So you get just the, and people, and I think, the Ridley Scott knows that you probably don't know much about any other character besides Napoleon.
Sure.
And so he doesn't try to give, he doesn't give you 3 hours and 26 minutes of a bunch of characters that you don't know and interweave this epic together. Yeah. He just gives you 2.5 hours of fight scenes in 1800s and
he kind of frames the story there. Yeah.
It's just fun.
I just,
if not,
okay,
dramatic.
I'll give you that. I think, yeah, I'm not sure what I would have wanted from a Napoleon movie to like it more. I didn't hate it. I think everything you're saying is true. You know, is there that there's some well staged, you know, guys on horses and that kind of sense of fighting and stuff, and it does seem to stick. I'm trying to think now. There must have been a couple scenes that he wasn't in, but it was really pretty much just his story and just him in every scene. And there was something purposely inscrutable about the character still, despite all, you're still removed from getting a true sense of his thinking. He does verbalize it in cases, and in those cases, I think is where he does seem sort of maybe vulnerable and maybe a bit pathetic or arrogant, and if that's the character, that's fine. I mean, I don't know. I mean, in time, like, you know, when everyone knew his wife was cheating on him and he didn't want to believe it, and then he decides, you know, to go back, and so he's sort of pleading with her and stuff. But, like, that's kind of pathetic.
You're with him in not believing that that was, even though, like, you know, it actually happened. You're like, in Napoleon's shoes, you would be surprised, right?
I don't know. I mean, maybe.
You're like, you'd be like, don't tell me my wife's cheating. I mean, who are you? I'm the great, like, military leader. What's the word for that?
I was a general at that
general,
time.
General, yeah. I'm not getting a wife cheating on me. Are you crazy?
I mean, I guess. It depends on if he's coming from a person who seems like he's telling him something that he doesn't want.
But that's the cool thing. Is you don't need to know right. you're the close people in this story. You don't... expect you to.
Right, yeah.
You're just with Napoleon and partially the wife. For one scene I do remember without Napoleon, it's of her cheating on him with the dude.
Yeah, I was thinking that too. I'm like, there is, I think, a scene
that's,
where they
that show, might be yeah, it.
Pretty much, yeah. There's a couple spots with the wife, maybe, with Josephine, and then,
in the beginning with the guillotine.
Yeah, that's true. They're kind of
No, isn't Napoleon in the crowd?
He's in the crowd right there. Yeah, that's a cool shot of him in the crowd with that kind of sort of grimace on his face.
That's the first introduction, and then, like, that introduction, you know everything you need about Napoleon. He's the guy that smiles at the queen, at Marie Antoinette getting beheaded.
I think I got the most depth of sensibility from that moment, and especially when you know the history of, like, he was like 20 or something at the time. At that point,
his face makes him look like he's 40.
Yeah, I know. That was a problem too. You didn't get as much of a sense of, like, this is a pretty young guy that's climbing up. You know, he was like 30.
That would make the 15 comment make more sense.
He was 33 or something when he was crowned emperor, I think. So, like, things moved quick for him, and he was very young. And the idea, the Corsican thing, and sort of the resentment of the French, and. I think it's another case where there's a lot there, so they have to kind of pick and choose what to demonstrate, what to show. And what he did do with it is kind of a more superficial, hey, let's just do some cool sequences with a big budget, and let's kind of frame it around this character, but we won't worry too much. I mean, there'll be the stuff with the wife, because people know about that, and there'll be some, you know, tantrums, because I guess he would have tantrums, but... And he could be gullible, maybe, or manipulated. You know, just the idea of, like, the guy saying, like, oh, yeah, and then they betray him, you know? He's like, we'll have peace, and then they don't have peace because they betray him or whatever. And the motivations for all that was a little tough to understand. Like, was he... He seemed like he wanted peace in places, which makes him a good leader, you know? He doesn't want people to die, but then he's also pushing. And then at the end of the movie, right, they decide with that text... to show the body counts for the wars and things, almost like they're sort of trying to bluntly say Napoleon was responsible for a lot of deaths.
Take that way.
And almost like, okay, so was this all instigated by him? Is it his fault that all these people died? Or were these wars going to happen whether he was there or not?
Just like,
some of it might have been his arrogance and his conquest, but... That was what everybody was doing back then. So do you know, I've heard people, I don't know, I heard this somewhere a long time ago, and it stuck in my head as like a, really? Where people were, like, the numerology shit, you know, like, you know, the you know, son of Satan kind of crap, and it's like, no, yeah, they were thinking that maybe it was either Napoleon, and then it was Hitler, and it's like, I don't think that I would put Napoleon and Hitler in the same category of, like, vile despots, you know? Napoleon was maybe tyrannical, but like you said, you have to judge these things in the historical context and see, like, okay, if he moved for peace with some of these people, then that's not quite that bad. And then if England is like, no, we're going to come over and try to take over France, it's like everyone was just trying to fucking fuck each other over with war back then. That all of Europe was doing that. And they're probably going to do it again here pretty soon. And it's just like, I guess I don't know how to feel. I don't know how the what the movie quite wants me to think about the character at the end, and what I think it based on like the body count stuff and stuff at the end is I think it wants me to just kind of reaffirm what the typical media story is, which is he was kind of an arrogant, immature, sort of pathetic, not, you know, kind of guy who kind of met his end and then they exiled him. But they exiled him twice, and the first time he comes back and his soldiers join back up
with
him.
Yeah, that part was great.
And there's in the documentary they talked about how like he was really kind of a, you know, a man of his soldiers to a degree. So I didn't really get that part was great in the movie, but I didn't really get too many other parts in the movie where you got a sense of like him being really with them, you know, necessarily.
When he's
at the very beginning when he charges and
with the cavalry, with his sword up and hacking, slashing people, you get that sense of
it. There's some of that, yeah. So,
but for the end text and the body's numbers, my 8th grade history teacher, when we were covering the Civil War, the first thing he did was like, this big number in the hundreds of thousands, I don't remember, we need to remember that this is how many people died. And, you know, like he would leave that up in the board just for people to see that, remember that all those people died. I think that number at the end was just kind of like that, where it's like, I mean, maybe it was unnecessary, but I don't think there was that much depth in it where we need to think of Napoleon differently. It was just like, hey, even though we made this cool movie about this cool general,
a lot of remember, people died.
Like, there's a lot of people that died from this.
Yeah, it might have been kind of chicken shit in that way, but it definitely, to me, it gave me the feeling of like, okay, you just told the story kind of maybe glorifying, but not really glorifying this character. I think
we got it pretty neutral. It's almost documentary, like the ending of him exiled when that's how that actually happened. Right. He was exiled and had a very...
The documentary says
6 years later.
Five and a half years later
after being exiled. Yeah. It's not very much of a glorious end, but it's what happened. And so that's how... I guess the story concludes.
It's interesting that they would do something like, politically speaking, why didn't they execute him? Or what would you do? It's an interesting time period there where it's like, what happens to great... Now, you could say it was because he had married the Austrian or whatever guy's daughter or something, you know, like with that whole thing. But, I mean, they're tough. It's hard to do a big... You're always going to cut stuff around. I'm not going to fault the movie for that. But at the same time, it didn't land as strongly for me as I would have liked in some places.
What were you expecting?
I don't know. I think I was expecting...
326 epic?
Maybe I was expecting to get more from the battles, even though I think the battles were pretty cool, you know, but
yeah,
and I was expecting to get a little bit more, like, to maybe kind of root for him a little more in the first third or so, kind of, because like it's weird. Okay, I'll give you one. So this is a perfect example for me of when I'm trying to figure out what the movie's doing, what it's trying to say about the character, right? Because it's about the character. So in that first sequence, when he comes up with the plan about, like, I'm really into it at the very beginning when it's like they're literally like forging smaller cannons from all the old metal.
Yeah, they're like making do with the...
He's coming up with a plan to like, okay, we're going to take back the fort. Then we're going to turn the cannons around.
How competent he is at being a general.
Well, really, that part was great. But and then you got, okay, he's going to lead these guys, and he leads up, and then the horse gets killed with the cannon that he's on, and he falls off. That was hardcore.
I was like,
but you're kind of sitting there like, okay, he does end up going back into it, but for a minute there it's kind of like, oh, he got shot off his horse and he seems kind of like stunned. And I think maybe it was in the performance. I was just like, is this supposed to be kind of goofy and funny now because of what happened?
It's supposed to be like,
it's horrific.
This could have happened in the 1800s, which you probably would never think of.
Yeah. And then how does he behave during that? Does he kind of...
He gets stunned. He gets stuck up and he's kind of scared.
But yeah, he does kind of keep going. So that part's interesting. But I at that moment I was kind of like, oh, how am I supposed to think about this? Is he... And then, of course, the part where he gets chased out of the political thing. That's pretty funny and pathetic, where he's like running away from Maul, and then they bring the soldiers and come back.
Why do you keep saying pathetic? He's always doing these things for a good reason.
It plays kind of... I'm just saying that some of those moments play kind of like in the... I guess it's hard for me to divorce myself from the way Napoleon's been depicted in other things as kind of a joke.
Yeah, the only depiction I have of him is basically this movie.
Well, then there you go. And you don't have those biases. I have them, and then I see them being... Put in the movie too, and being like, is that just them kind of going to like the, isn't Napoleon short and kind of goofy, and it's like a little bit.
He's a little, yeah. He's like slightly below average.
That's the truth too. Is that for that time too, he really wasn't that short. So I don't know. I think because it's just like with Lawrence of Arabia or something, like with these big epics that are kind of character drawn, where they're becoming leaders and stuff. They're not fantasies, so it's not like the leader is an all good guy and does the right thing, and it's the Luke Skywalker hero of the story. But there are points when you kind of, like I said, you root for them and you want them to work and to win and maybe make some right decisions and see what happens, you know. And I had trouble in Napoleon and kind of getting anything for that. I'm kind of wanting to root for this guy while I'm watching this movie, just like in the sense of like if you watch a movie about like a bank robber, you don't necessarily agree that robbing banks is a good idea, but you're watching him rob the bank and you kind of want him to get away with it.
It's kind of like a prequel in that you know it's not going to go well, especially with like the Russian part and all the deaths.
Sure, yeah. I mean, even I didn't know that history necessarily when I watched Napoleon, so the movie engaging to me.
I was
really weak on that stuff, so that's why I watched the documentary after, because I wanted to see how much of it was going to either just, if the documentary was going to contradict any of it. And as far as I can tell, it really didn't. But I don't remember anything about the Spain stuff in the Ridley Scott movie. Because he kind of has things kind of dialed in at one point in real life, apparently. According to the documentary, he's kind of, you know, like, okay, things are kind of peaceful. And then he decides he wants to try to invade Spain to try to bring the French sensibility there, and the people are not down for it. So it's really just kind of a bloody, awful, like that's his first real military strategic mistake, is to kind of go into there. I think the Russia stuff happens after that. Or maybe Spain is after the Russia. I don't remember, but it was just he spread out a little too far in places. I didn't get quite as much of a sense of that, arc for the character as like kind of like he just like what is he trying to get at the beginning versus at the end. I didn't see that, and so that's fine. I mean, I needed something to be more obvious and it wasn't there, and you know,
yeah, I guess.
But I'm glad you liked it.
I
didn't hate it, but you know,
there was a big, oh, I completely forgot the main plot was that he couldn't get a dang heir.
That wasn't the main plot, but...
That's what I thought was the main plot.
He couldn't have... His wife couldn't bury him a son, yeah.
Why aren't you pregnant?
Yeah.
He kept bothering her about that, and... I forget how he finally... Does he not get one?
No. No, it's kind of a big deal in their story, because he wrote all these letters to her. He really was apparently very devotedly in love with her. And even after their divorce, which they did for France.
And then there's the crazy scene of him
and then he,
going to test his fertility with the 18-year-old.
Right, yeah.
And like that, when that scene happened, I was so like, I was thinking, this is a great performance. Because you can see, like, you already know Napoleon's kind of like a nervous, but just, like, supposed to be confident general. And he's going into this room where he's supposed to have sex with this woman that he's never seen before. But this is, like, 1800s, so maybe this is what you're supposed to be normal. Even though you can see that like he's this is a guy, is a human just like me and you, and you can see the nervousness on his face and the he has to like tough it out walking over to her, looking at her, because you can see her face, and he just has to like say hi and then blow out the candles. And I thought that was played, like, I couldn't think of a better way to play that.
Yeah, I mean,
No,
I don't remember it as vividly as you do, but I do remember that part. Yeah, is the idea of like, you know, of figuring that out, and yeah, that's another case where it's sort of okay. It's more about the political machinations of other people, kind of, as well as him. You know, like these people are, and so it gets into that a little bit. It's just hard to do something. You say if it's going to be about just him, but then you have to kind of, but it's also about France and it's also about all these other countries and what was the nature of those conflicts. And it's like, well, the movie's not about that. Well, okay. But in order to frame this character and all these decisions he's making, if you don't get some more of that information, then you're kind of given a limited sense. And so you're having a tough time knowing, like, okay, I don't know the history well enough. I think this is a case where you'd either know the history better, and then you would be able to say, okay, they did a good job, because I know those things. It's like when you read the book and you watch a movie and you're like, oh yeah, yeah, I get this part better because I've read the book. But if somebody's watching the movie, they're going to be a little bit confused.
I think that's my criticism of Killers, is Killers would be a lot better if you knew all the background, while this one, you can just go into it knowing nothing and be like, because I think this movie's kind of like a Pulp Fiction of just Napoleon scenes, where it's like, now he's in leading the battle. Now his wife isn't giving
him. I see what you mean by Pulp Fiction.
Now he has to go.
It's a series of vignettes. That's the term you're talking about.
And so it, like, there is the overarching sort of thing where he doesn't have the heir and he loves his wife, but his wife's cheating on him. And the whole wife problem, even while he's conquering the world, it's the struggle between the greatest, most well-known guy in the 1800s while he's dealing with a normal person's struggle of his wife can't conceive. And it really is just like, vignettes of
And that's what it would have to be.
They could capture on film.
Yeah, that would be, you'd be like, okay.
Was it film? I bet it wasn't.
I don't know. It didn't look terrible to me.
No.
But I mean,
the CGI horse getting cannonballed was kind of like, I think that was the only thing.
It was done in the dark too, so they did it fairly smartly. Yeah, that's just how you have to do a lot of these things. I think certain historical things, maybe, I'm trying to think. So like Barry Lyndon is fictitious and it's fairly long, and it works because it's just like, you're just watching this character's meandering life. You're not kind of wanting a bigger sense of the picture or a little bit more of a fairer take on the reality of what might have been going on with this leader. Something like Amadeus, I don't know if you've seen that. That's about Mozart. That's
pressing clips.
That I like that one. It's a little more fun, and it has this core idea of like the tortured artist versus kind of the talent, the God-given talent that kind of just is goofing around. Like the idea of somebody who's just stays up partying all night.
I've seen
and still better than you at the thing you really want
to
be good at.
The one clip where like some guy goes to impress some guy, and then and they ask Mozart to play something.
Play Salieri, yeah, and then
he just goes and he's like, it was like this, right? Just from hearing it, he's like, well, what if we added this to it?
Yeah, he makes it better immediately. Yeah, that is an interesting movie in that sense. But once again, talking about historical thing where it's like, I don't really know, like that could, a lot of that could be very fictitious, but I can enjoy that as the movie and I don't need it. Yeah. I feel
that Mozart
with certain historical things, it's more important to me. And, I don't know why, but it just kind of, maybe because it's about wars and it's about nations and it's about how people feel about leaders and it's about how the media portrays. So, you know, you've heard the term, right? You know, history is written by the winners.
Mm-hmm.
So Napoleon won a lot, but ultimately lost. So look at how he's how he's portrayed in this movie, and look at how he's been portrayed. Like,
How do you think he's portrayed in this movie? Like, if you could simplify it.
I keep going back to pathetic. And I think that's the term. Yeah.
I
think there's something.
I think he's portrayed as
intrinsically kind of. He's got kind of a frustrated.
A great general, and then but period in reference to lacking other things, like an heir.
Sure.
So, like saying pathetic, like undermines the great general part of the
film. Oh, absolutely, it does. Yeah.
So you think that's what the movie's getting at?
I think it is getting at that. Yeah.
Why?
I don't know, because okay, if you were gonna do a movie about George Washington,
yeah,
would it play out in a similar way as this movie?
I don't think actually.
It's a different character.
I don't know how you would do it because George Washington is such a legend.
That's what I mean. And Napoleon
is as a legend as George Washington, at least in America.
That's what we're getting at. We're getting at the idea of histories written by the winners, and the people that ultimately lose get their legacies modified, and it, given enough time, maybe like in Alexander the Great, then that legacy, it's just always putting some critical thinking behind, okay, now was this character like what's the motivation of a modern person to try to portray this historical character, this quote-unquote legend or infamous character or whatever. What are they trying to get at by either humanizing them what level of layers are they doing there? Like, to what ends? Like, who benefits? What purpose does this serve? Other than to be entertaining, like you said, because, hey, he goes to Egypt and, that's kind of cool. Some neat visuals for a moment there, though that might have all been CG for all I know. I'm losing my eye for these things.
It
still felt kind of epic, but it also felt kind of like, well, that was just like a couple of shots for the sake of showing Egypt. Yeah, exactly. I mean, they didn't do a lot with it. And there really might not historically be a lot to have done with that. But yeah, those are where the questions get interesting. So, I mean, I guess the subject we're talking about, if you want to, we could just do Oppenheimer now too, because now we're getting to this idea of historical stuff, getting into a character, how that character's portrayed, what that character does, and the events of that character's actions affects the rest of us and the rest of the world.
Yeah, I mean, I said my main thing about Oppenheimer, which was that, like, it's 3 hours on the dot, and the parts I was most interested in were the parts where I knew something.
You knew other historical figures.
Right. And so I could get something from the interaction between Oppenheimer and the character. I could get a little bit of the, factor.
But once again, you've got a story that's like literally, just like Napoleon, it's about the character. So the fact that you're introducing other characters you kind of know.
Napoleon is at 3 hours, though.
Well, I mean, it's 25 minutes less.
And does it have 1800s language and chopping heads off?
Okay. And it does, but it does
have my critique of Oppenheimer.
It does have this idea of a group project. Oh, it doesn't have anyone being killed. Yeah, good.
That's
point.
That's why it's boring.
It's so boring. Yeah. No one gets decapitated with a guillotine, but a whole bunch of Japanese people get incinerated.
Even in Killers, you have people getting murdered, and you have him, like, indirectly killing her. Sure. Directly killing her slowly from the poison. Like, you get close-ups of that. But you don't... You just get, like...
Yeah, Oppenheimer
is... Adultery. It's like, ooh, adultery. We haven't seen that in a movie before.
And that's not... Really, that's the weaker part of the story.
I've heard the argument for this being a critically great film because it's just such a great deep dive on the mind of Oppenheimer and this contrast in his mind, I guess, between like the, like they have the two things where before it's like a lot of, like they have the like kind of spacey shots before and after the bomb where it's like fission and button like atoms and stuff where he's thinking about the stuff and then after the bomb then he's haunted by it.
Right.
It's like, oh, but I don't know. I feel like I get that and I'm not that, I don't think that's such an ingenious thing.
I think that maybe, yeah, maybe we'll revisit it after we've both seen it twice. I don't know if you have any desire to see it again. I think I will eventually want to.
I'll watch it again.
I think if you watch it more as the character study, again. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I like movies about like a team of people like trying to accomplish something. And it has that, and so I liked that. Which
I think
is, you know,
the stakes were dumbed down.
Well, like, there might have been plenty of dumbed down stuff, but I mean, the stakes are very simple. You know, we've got to build the bomb before the Nazis get it. Done. Bam. Simple does not mean dumb, so it just means straightforward.
No, I mean, like we knew, like, I was waiting, I remember waiting in the theater for the moment when, like, he was gonna get reprimanded. And I don't think he ever did. Like, he was always the one putting the blame on himself.
Sure.
Even when people were telling him that it wasn't his fault. Like, he was just making the bomb. It wasn't his decision. Like Truman said, it was Truman's idea to drop it. To drop it, not his. And yet he...
It was Truman's responsibility as the commander-in-chief of the military forces of the United States of America to make that decision. Yeah.
Yeah.
So heavy is the crown for Truman there, which is like, in seeing that performance again, I'd be curious to see how Oldman comes in and what he brings there. I think that there's something good there about, like,
that was like the pinnacle part of it for me was him meeting with Truman, and like we had gotten scenes of him before where he was like with the crowd and all of them chanting his name, even though he feels distraught about making it because he knows all the people that died from it. He meets Truman and he's like, I feel like I have blood on my hands. Mm-hmm. And Truman's like, you just made the bomb. You didn't do shit. I dropped the bomb. It was my decision.
Yeah.
I forgot. Maybe I can just shove it in here, but I guess who's the director of Oppenheimer?
Christopher Nolan.
Yeah, I guess him just making Oppenheimer feel so guilty about it was him going to me directly and saying, fuck you,